Any preliminary questions or issues? Okay. We left off last time just sort of mentioning the problem of loss of a chance, but not yet really addressing it. Again, the question is whether or not it's a good idea to modify our expectation for the plaintiff's level of proof. The traditional burden on the plaintiff is to show that the defendant's negligence is a cause without which the injury would not have occurred, the so-called but-for standard. By contrast, you can certainly imagine cases, we talked about them yesterday with reference to Dillon, in which the plaintiff had a chance of avoiding the injury, but the defendant took that chance away. The fact that the plaintiff's chance at the time the defendant's negligence occurred was still not at the point of saying, gee, but for the defendant's negligence, the plaintiff could have avoided injury. It's not that strong, but is it nothing? So Hardy raises that question. Can somebody tell us about Hardy Phone Company? Mr. Viviana. And again, we would have all sorts of interesting questions in Chapter 1 about whether, in fact, you could fairly characterize the phone companies having been negligent. What, you know, with what degree you could talk about the, you know, industry custom. You could look at the cost of a crash-proof system or the cost of some sort of super emergency dialing sequence that would get past a jam like this. But let's assume for purposes of discussion that the plaintiff could convince us that the defendant did not use reasonable care in setting up a 911 system that was so vulnerable to this kind of failure. Okay, now we've got the Chapter 2 problem, which is, did that negligence cause the plaintiff's injury? Okay, so again, if we apply the test, the traditional test, to this fact pattern, we say that no reasonable jury could find that, more probably than not, with reasonable care, she would have had a better outcome. In all probability, or at least more probably than not, exactly the same thing would have happened with reasonable care as actually happened without reasonable care. Thus, according to the traditional rule, the plaintiff's case fails. But the plaintiff says, I don't think that's the way we ought to resolve this case. Instead, says the plaintiff, and the court actually spends a little time explaining to us what the rationale was in the medical malpractice cases. Why in the medical malpractice cases did the courts adopt this loss of a chance theory? Well, I'm not sure that applies to most cases. It may only apply to some, but those to whom that principle does apply, let's say you have a doctor whose specialty is oncology, you know, the treatment of cancer, and let's suppose in that practice the majority of patients come to the doctor in a condition where the doctor can only help them in less than 50% of the cases. What's the problem? Why don't we simply say, well, as to those people, essentially there's no tort remedy? And to adopt the loss of, or that failure to adopt the loss of a chance doctrine in medical malpractice cases, they said, would place patients with pre-existing conditions in peril. I think the image in the court's mind is that doctors would go through their medical charts, you know, and identify the patients with a less than 50% chance and put a little happy face sticker next to that one, saying, in effect, don't worry about this one. This is a free shot on goal here. No downside to treating this patient. Well, that seems a little bit that's sort of a strange little fantasy that we might have that patients really would be in peril because doctors would respond in that way. I think doctors have a few other things besides the threat of a malpractice suit that motivates them to provide their patients with good medical care. But whether that's a sick fantasy or whether it reflects a real concern, does that apply to this case? Why not? Okay, so there are a couple of unique things about medical practice, one being, again, this doctor-patient relationship and this fear, rational or irrational, that the doctors would somehow use it to the patient's disadvantage. We're less worried that phone companies are going to make up lists of, oh, gee, you know, that call's coming in for Garth Brooks, put it through. That's coming from a patient with a 40% chance of survival. Put them on hold. So to that extent, there's conditions present in medical practice that wouldn't be extended. The other thing that's unique about medical practice is that you have a statistical bank, so that you have statistics on people with liver cancer or people with glaucoma or people with a separated shoulder, where you know statistically this percentage of patients treated in this way get this degree of improvement. We don't have that kind of uniformity, or at least maybe it's an artificial uniformity, but you couldn't as easily transfer that to traffic accidents. You can't say, you know, 40% of people who get hit in rear-end collisions have this kind of injury. Every accident is sufficiently different. Such that, again, we don't have a bank of statistics that are comparable to the statistics we have in medicine. So as you say, the court finds the analogy to be misplaced, that the phone company dealing with their customers is not analogous to doctors dealing with their patients, and therefore the need, the desirability of the application of a loss of chance doctrine simply doesn't apply. So, again, as you think about this problem, I've said before that part of the, perhaps one of the most important aspects of your analysis of these causation cases is to make sure you understand what challenges your client will face and whether or not you need to explore one of these doctrines that provides an exception to the traditional rule. If your case fits within that category of cases where, in effect, the plaintiff was already heading toward a bad result, that barring the defendant's intervention in some fashion, the plaintiff was already in a bad way, where the defendant's negligence extinguishes any chance the plaintiff might have had to avoid that bad outcome, the traditional rule again says, well, that's not a but-for cause of the injury. You might want to argue, however, for an extension of this loss of a chance theory to such a case, and as the notes indicate, there is some, you know, scholarly interest in a broader application of loss of a chance. But the courts, when they think about applying it, have exactly the concerns you indicated. Gee, this is taking a walk on the wild side. It would dramatically affect the scope of liability, and we don't want to go there without having a firm basis in policy for doing so. And while they found that in medical care, they don't find it here. So. Questions about loss of a chance? That can be addressed. Okay, the last item we have on our checklist here as far as exceptions to the traditional burden of establishing but-for causation is what I have called multiple redundant causes. That's not a sort of official legal term. It's one I've tried to apply here so that you can identify those kinds of cases where this substantial factor test is used. That's the legal category that you will more commonly find in cases and elsewhere. And there's some reference you may recall back in Mitchell versus Gonzalez when the court in Mitchell versus Gonzalez decides to use the substantial factor test. Justice Kennard points out, gee, we've used this, but in a different context. So this is the context in which it is appropriately used. So can somebody tell us about Purcell? Ms. Rossi, can you tell us about Purcell? Go ahead. Okay, so let's assume for purposes of discussion that each of these manufacturers deposits a certain number of fibers, asbestos fibers, into the plaintiff's lungs, and let's assume for purposes of discussion that they were negligent in doing so, that they knew about the hazards of asbestos but didn't share the information about those hazards with the plaintiff, and that a reasonable person would have shared that information so the plaintiff could take appropriate preventive measures to avoid this disease. What's the issue with respect to causation here? Why is this a problem? Okay, what we know is that he has mesothelioma, that the mesothelioma is caused by asbestos exposure. We also know that each of these 12 defendants put some of the asbestos in his lungs that caused the disease. Where's the problem with respect to causation? If you were the defendant, suppose you're defendant number 12, and suppose you appear in the course of time. In fact, it's not sequenced in this way. They're all mixed up. You know, you use a little bit here, a little bit there. But suppose you had them in sequence. Defendant number one exposed him. Defendant number two, three, four, five, six, seven. Finally, defendant 12 is the last one to provide the asbestos that whose fibers winds up in the plaintiff's lungs. If you were defendant number 12 and the plaintiff wants to hold you liable, what would you say with respect to causation? Okay, and what is the legal test? Something is, the defendant's negligence is a cause of the plaintiff's injury if we can say what? What is it we need to say? How do we define proximate cause? A proximate cause is that's this new fangled animal. Our old traditional test, if you didn't have this new angle, what's our traditional test? A proximate cause is, yes, it is a cause without which the injury would not have occurred. So if I'm defendant number 12, and I've just heard the testimony about how all these asbestos fibers were already in his lungs, I would say, what difference did I make? It's the plaintiff's burden to show that if only I'd restrained myself, if I'd warned him and he worn a respirator or otherwise avoided inhaling my fibers, that he'd be walking around happy-go-lucky today. If you find that, ladies and gentlemen, more probable than not, that but for my exposure or my product's influence on his life, he would have avoided this injury. Fine, hold me liable, but that's the legal test. Don't hold me liable just because you don't like me or because you feel sorry for the plaintiff, unless my product caused his injury, but for my product, no injury, no liability. Now, let's suppose for a moment we did let number 12 off the hook. Wouldn't the same logic apply to number 1 through 11? Defendant number 1 would then come forward and say, you know what, if I hadn't exposed the plaintiff, look at all the other asbestos he was going to get in his lungs. How do you know mine made a difference? And number 2, 3, 4, 5, each of the defendants essentially makes the same argument. The plaintiff's burden is to show, but for my negligence, but for my product, no injury. And the plaintiff says, I don't think I should be expected to meet that level of proof. You could easily have a case in which the jury was convinced that together the exposure caused the injury, that all these people were negligent, but when you try to isolate any one of them, you cannot say with respect to any one of them that defendant's behavior is a but-for cause of the injury. Now you begin to see why it is that a court might say, wait a minute, a strict unbending application of the traditional but-for-cause test could result in an honest jury returning with a verdict for all of the defendants and telling the plaintiff, you did too good a job of proving how much asbestos each of these defendants put in your lungs. Sermon embarrassment of riches here. Now, the court says, instead of using the traditional but-for test, we're going to use what kind of a test? Ms. Rossi, what's the alternative? If you have multiple redundant causes, don't use the but-for cause test, says the plaintiff. Mr. Edwards? Yeah, use the substantial factor test so that you ask of each defendant, no longer is the test, you're only liable if your negligence is a cause without which the injury would not have occurred. We're not going to impose that high a test on the plaintiff. We're going to say to the plaintiff, all you have to tell us, all the jury has to find is that this exposure was a substantial factor. Do we know what that means, by the way? Okay, that's the basis for the test, but how do I know, for example, suppose one of these defendants is shown to have made a product where the plaintiff worked on the job site where this product was being used. The plaintiff worked there for 3 weeks. And he was a carpenter, and there were a bunch of people cutting insulation blankets that contained asbestos and mixing up a paste or cement to connect these insulating blankets on a big boiler. But he was on the job site for 3 weeks, mostly working over in the carpenter area, but occasionally they'd walk past the place where this product was being used. Is that a substantial factor? Ms. Anderson. Okay, it was essentially a jury question at that point. The defendant wanted to impose these sort of substantiality requirements to say, okay, it's got to be at least this much in terms of the time of exposure and the proximity to the actual product. And the court refuses to make a sort of hard and fast rule there. They say, we're going to let the jury decide for themselves what a substantial exposure is. But again, it would vary from case to case. You can imagine a different kind of toxic exposure situation. Let's suppose, for example, I live next door to a landfill. And in this landfill are so-called organic solvents. There are things like the chemicals they use in a dry cleaning establishment, and the machinery in the dry cleaning establishment generates lint, and the lint is saturated with these organic chemicals, and the dump trucks would come and put this stuff in the landfill, and then the chemicals would leach out of the landfill into the drinking water, the people who live next door. Well, at some point we have to figure out among the different people that supplied this chemical that turned out to injure the plaintiff, what's a substantial factor. If it takes a certain level of exposure to this chemical before you suffer any harm, then maybe in different places you would have different standards for what's a substantial factor. Here, as you were saying, the level of exposure that it takes to generate the disease is exceedingly low. You may know the Stephen Jay Gould, the paleontologist, wrote lots of books on biology and actually appeared in Ken Burns' thing on baseball because he was, alas, he died before his beloved Red Sox made it to the playoffs. But Gould worked in the Museum of Natural History in New York, and his own exposure to asbestos was apparently that the specimen drawers for all these fossils kept in the Museum of Natural History, the drawers were lined with asbestos in case a fire occurred, it would spare the precious fossils. But apparently, just from opening and closing these drawers, he had enough exposure, so he had mesothelioma. Died about 2 years ago, I think. So again, the women whose husbands were insulation workers, some of the women whose only exposure to asbestos was in laundering their husband's clothing, they got mesothelioma. So it's a strange kind of disease where, again, this minute exposure. So when we ask the jury, what's a substantial factor? Do you find that this defendant's product was a substantial factor in causing the plaintiff's injury? We have some flexibility in letting the jury make that determination. Notice again from the defendant's standpoint that this seems like a very unfair rule. If I make a product and it was on the job site and this plaintiff was only there for 3 weeks, and I'm saying, wait a minute, of all the asbestos this guy was exposed to, why am I being brought into this? And the court's answer is it's up to the jury to decide what's a substantial factor. And we won't apply the traditional but-for cause test, again, based on the idea that if we applied that strictly, we could be in a situation in which nobody was held liable. Not that we're opposed to that, that we never allow a plaintiff to go uncompensated, but from the standpoint that a plaintiff who's been injured from all of these different causes, it would seem a strange result if the plaintiff in the end was told, I'm sorry, there are too many people who injured you, that's why you can't recover. So the test has changed to make sure that that unjust result doesn't occur. You may be aware, I don't know if you've talked about this in criminal law, there's a parallel doctrine in criminal law. If seven gangsters say, we'd like to bump this guy off, but none of us wants to go away for a long time, if each of us, on the count of three, you make up your own mind, this is, let your conscience be your guide, but at the count of three, if you feel like shooting this guy, now's the time to do it. And all of them fire and fire a fatal shot. Does that mean that none of them caused the death because none of them can be said to be a cause without which the injury would not have occurred? No. There's some conspiracy problems there, too. It's hard to make up a hypothetical. But the point is, again, in criminal law, the normal rule of causation that says if my behavior didn't cause this person's injury, I may be liable for some attempted crime, but I can't be liable for a crime which requires a result if, in fact, my conduct can't be said to have caused the result. Where there are these multiple redundant causes, the law will, again, apply a different kind of rule, a substantial factor test, as distinguished from the ordinary rule of but-for causation. Yeah. Well, there was an attempt early on in the asbestos cases to use a Sindel-type theory. And in general, with respect to the Sindel, with respect to the asbestos cases, the court said, as a matter of fact, we do have substantial information. We know where these guys work, and we know what products they are exposed to. And whereas a Sindel theory is appropriate where you have one and only one defendant who caused the injury and we don't know which one, the asbestos cases are ones in which multiple defendants contributed a little bit to a cumulative injury. And therefore, it's really not analogous to a Sindel-type case. It's actually much better for the defendants, it's much better for the plaintiffs to be able to argue that each defendant caused the injury, because then each defendant is held liable rather than some kind of market share theory, which would limit you to the individual share assigned by the market. Yeah. Well, in the case of asbestos, we actually come back to a case in Chapter 3 that talks about punitive damages, and they actually award not just compensatory damages because they failed to use reasonable care, they apply punitive damages because they actually knew full well about the dangers, and in fact, there was a doctor, a guy named Irving Selikoff, who kind of made it his life work and campaign to warn about the dangers because he was aware of how small the exposure was that triggered this horrible disease. And he tried to alert public health officials and other likely people about the dangers of asbestos. And the asbestos companies actually targeted him in the same way General Motors targeted Ralph Nader to try to discredit him and prevent this message from being communicated. Literally? Oh. Oh, it's Montana, that's right. Yeah, okay. Oh, yeah. Sorry. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Okay. Well, I Ms. McLaughlin. Well, we would have gotten there in a civil action, except that you remember not Principal Skinner, but Judge Skinner sequenced the thing so that the jury first had to find that the chemicals even got into the water. So until the jury made a finding, and they didn't with respect to, wasn't it Beatrice, where they said their chemicals never got into the water, and only W.R. Grace was found to have put chemicals that wound up in the well. But if they had found that there were multiple defendants who put these chemicals in the water, then you would have had this. And it would have been a very difficult case to establish, again, the medical link and all that sort of stuff. But you'll recall, again, just from a strategic standpoint, that the lawyer for Beatrice, his name escapes me now, the Harvard guy, what was his name? Fasher, yeah. He knew from day one that you had to keep the victims off the witness stand. If they get on the witness stand, it's history. Because from that, the jury will almost be compelled to make the finding of the connection. But so long as he could keep the issue about plumes of organic solvents in a geological formation, then he could keep the jury from his client. So, yeah. Sort of. Again, the question about joint as distinguished from individual liability is, again, our Chapter 6 question. And it turns out that you could assign individual shares. In fact, you could do it pretty readily in the case of asbestos exposure, where, for example, you could say that of the exposure this guy had, these people are 10%, these guys are 25, and so forth. The problem is whether or not you want to use that information to limit each defendant's liability, particularly where these three are bankrupt, these four have settled, and we're down to two defendants who are left. Then it gets very difficult to figure out how you're going to allocate the liability at that point. But again, I want to postpone till Chapter 6 the intricacies of all that working out. Yeah. Well, I'm not sure actually where the court was going with that, except this is my speculation here, that again, the Sindel situation is different from this situation. How is Sindel different? Tell me again. Okay, but in terms of the mechanism of the accident, though, if you had 12 manufacturers of DES and one Judith Sindel, only one of them supplied the product. And remember that the Summers versus Tice principle, actually, they're referring to more of a Summers versus Tice theory, that applies when you have all the defendants who could have caused the injury. And that's different from having a whole bunch of defendants who each contributed a little bit, but what we don't know is not so much, it's not that we don't know exactly whose fibers are in the plaintiff's system. We're assuming we could actually get down and, you know, we could find the little UPC code on each of these little fibers. Oh yeah, this one belongs, you know, we could determine that precisely. We'd still be in the quandary of saying, but how do we know how much of this was enough to cause his disease? If we're never going to be able to make that determination, and if we place the burden on the plaintiff to show, without this guy's product, no disease, without this guy's product, no disease, if that were the burden placed on the plaintiff, he'd lose, because that's not something we're likely to know. Another parallel that actually comes up fairly frequently are situations where a driver consumes alcohol at multiple locations. So that somebody goes, in effect, bar hopping, has two drinks here, a drink there, three drinks there, then gets into his car, drives, and hits somebody. and the victim sues the drinking establishments where the liquor was served, and they're prepared to show that the driver was visibly intoxicated and should not have been served. Each supplier of alcohol will say, well, hey, I only sold him one drink. Over a six-hour period, he wound up with a 0.18 blood alcohol content. How can you say my one drink, you know, if I hadn't sold him that beer? Well, so courts have used the same analysis, substantial factor analysis, with respect to a supplier of alcohol, because we can't say, oh, gee, but for that one, before that drink, you were fine. After that drink, you were impaired. It doesn't work like that. So to the extent, again, you have this mixture of a variety of different sources of the harm, and you can't distinguish the role that each one played, that's where the plaintiff says, I should get the benefit of a substantial factor test, because if you impose the traditional test, I'll have so many defendants, you'll say I get nothing. Like Yogi Berra says, that restaurant's so busy, nobody goes there anymore. Go ahead. Right. Oh, absolutely. A medal, even. Right. I don't think that's true. See, that's the difference. That if you come into my drinking establishment and I serve you alcohol, until such point as you are visibly intoxicated, I do no wrong by serving you. However, if I'm selling asbestos and it's dangerous and I fail to warn you about the dangers of asbestos, the first fiber I put into your lungs, I'm potentially on the hook for. So, moral of the story is serve alcohol, not asbestos. I think. Yeah. Okay. Okay, other questions about multiple redundant causes, but for causation generally? Yes? It's on a jurisdiction-by-jurisdiction basis. I would say, the Hardy case is a pretty representative reaction of a court to the invitation, keep going in this direction. And Hardy says, in effect, no, we don't want to go there. But, again, if I were in a situation where that's my only alternative, I would at least consider a loss of a chance theory as a potential way to save me from an otherwise hopeless case. But if I'm going to make a loss of a chance argument, I should be prepared to show why the public policy of this state would favor an expansive rather than restrictive interpretation of it. Yeah. Well, yes, exactly. So again, as we compare this to something like Summers versus Tice, where you say, hey, unless you have all of the people in the courtroom, or even a market share liability, which says you have to have a substantial share of the market, in a substantial factor kind of case where each defendant, in effect, caused some part of the harm, it's not, well, it's possible you may be the person who caused the harm. You probably weren't, but there's a possibility you were. In an asbestos case, or in the alcohol serving cases that I talked about, where it's established that the defendant contributed to the thing that caused the harm, that's really a different situation. In that case, the court says, even if you're just one of 12, if the jury finds you were a substantial factor, the plaintiff's entitled to a judgment against you. In what form that judgment, you know, whether it's a liability for the whole or whether it's liability for a piece, we haven't quite worked out yet. But there's nothing to prevent that one of 12 or those three of 12 from being the only ones who are held liable. Meanwhile, as I said earlier in the asbestos cases, many other defendants are bankrupt or settled the case for a modest amount or have some other reason why they're not at the party. Yes, that has to be your argument to the jury, and it may be you can say, you know, ladies and gentlemen, the evidence in this case was the plaintiff only worked at the site where my product was used for 3 weeks. You know, he worked for 5 years over here. He was in an open-air environment where, you know, wasn't as constricted. In the other cases, he was down working in a steam tunnel. You know, I don't think you should find on this evidence that the product my client supplied was a substantial factor. If the jury agrees with you on that point, fine, they'll let you out. But again, the defendant sure doesn't like being in that situation of saying, in effect, my product, in effect, had nothing to do with this. That's a fairly tough burden. It wasn't even a substantial factor in causing the injury. Particularly, again, when the evidence of your client's negligence is very strong, and the jury's not particularly happy with your conduct, when you say, yeah, we did a bad thing, but maybe it didn't cause this guy's harm, you're going to have a harder time getting the jury to be sympathetic with you. Yeah. Well, no, I think the defendant was asking to set these thresholds to say, unless you meet these tests, you can't say that's a substantial factor. And the court said, we aren't going to impose a rigid criterion by which, you know, this is, you have to fit within this box. They left it more to the jury's discretion, in effect, to say, we find or we don't find it's a substantial factor. But if I'm the defendant, I can certainly bring that out to say, in finding whether something is a substantial factor, you certainly can and should consider what degree of exposure there was and under what circumstances. Okay? All right. Well, we just have a... We don't really have any time at all here. Next time, obviously, we switch, and I'm not going to talk about Berry versus Sugarknife yet, but I want to just make sure we understand the transition we're making from looking at but-for causation, which is about the facts. It's about what happened, and trying our best to say this happened, that didn't happen. As we shift over into legal cause, it's no longer about the facts, it's now really about values. We're trying to decide whether it's fair to impose liability on a garage owner whose car is stolen and then is involved in a high-speed chase where the plaintiff gets injured. Is it fair to say that a Kmart who sells a rifle to a drunk guy is liable for what that drunk guy then does with the hunting rifle? These are questions, as Justice Kennard said, it's a normative evaluative process. We're trying to decide what the limits of legal liability ought to be based on what we think is fair. So that doesn't mean anything goes. We may have legal rules that set up what our social values are and how they limit or expand liability. But it means that we're in an area where, again, the terms of the debate are not so much figuring out what happened as it is figuring out what we want to do about the things that we have found. So we'll start Berry versus Sugar Notch on Monday.